This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
It's unpaid bill prop over there. I'm Bob Fass, and we should be here until 3:30 this morning. Good morning, Cabal. And if things go as I had hoped this morning, we'll be joined soon by Tom Newman, who was a member of an organization that whose name I don't believe I can't mention it because they're not yet in the safe harbor in Kisilov, which is about 9 hours. 9 hours different? No, can't be that. Quite a few hours different. And by 2:30 in the morning, it will be possible for us to mention the name of this group that I have to remind you, some of you may not be aware of this, but there was a time in recent history, in living memory, when Mario Savio said, "Sometimes the workings of the machine are so intolerable to you, such an affront to your humanity, so bloody and senseless and brutal that you have practically no choice but to throw your body on the machine." And thousands and thousands of young Americans were being killed and wounded and turned into murderers of tens of thousands of people in Vietnam and later in Cambodia. And it was intolerable. It was intolerable. There were moments when I think it was Bill Ayers, who was a weatherman, friend of Obama, said, "You could be studying, or you could be eating, or you could be waking up from a night's sleep. You could be taking a trip on LSD, and all you thought of every moment was that these murders were being committed in your name." And it wasn't just the fact that this war, unlike the wars that the United States has been ruining itself in lately, these wars were overwhelmingly unpopular, and people were demonstrating in massive numbers, students, the professions, the healing professions, lawyers, steel workers, everyone who thought about it realized that this was unbearable. And the violence that occurred in this country as a, well, it was in the air. We saw pictures of mass murder, places like My Lai. We saw carpet bombing of peaceful villages. We saw people being shot in the street without trials. We saw atrocities being committed in our name, much like the present day. And, of course, now that we have a president who I do not believe has ever served in the military, and I can't remember another president that we've had. Let's see. Well, George Bush W. He went absent without leave, but he did serve in the military. Bill Clinton, well, he wouldn't fess up to the fact that he had been an anti-war activist and had dodged the draft so that he wouldn't have to join. Jimmy Carter was a naval officer. George Herbert, first Bush, daddy, he was certainly a Cold Warrior and one of those guys who jumped from airplanes when there was nothing the matter with them. And let's see, even Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a stint as Secretary of the Navy. So, I mean, all of these guys up until our present president had a military background, and now we have somebody who doesn't know what it's like to receive an order to kill someone and then to have to do it. So maybe there will be some movement. I mean, it's not the only problem that we've got to find a way out of, for sure. But when all of these violent acts were being done in the name of the United States of America and of the citizens of the United States of America, there were other violent acts that were going on in the country. There was a murder of a president and his brother. There was a kind of a cult wet dream of a hippie murderer in the Mansons. There were assassinations of Martin Luther King. There were assassinations of Malcolm X. All of these were raising the level of, I don't know, like, you could almost smell the blood in the world at that time. And people got, I don't know, got blood in their eyes. And violences of astonishing proportion took place. The group that I was talking about, whose name I won't be able to say on the air until KWMD is in safe harbor, is the subject of a book by one of its prime members who was here with us this morning. His name then was Tom Newman, and then it was Tom, the name of the group. And now he has another name that he's acquired because of his profession as a barrister. He's a lawyer, and he represents people in OSHA claims, and people call him and say, OSHA, wow. And that's his name.
You're giving out misinformation.
Well, what's the difference?
Well, you know, we're still going to try here to have a semblance of reality. I know it's after midnight, but are people listening.
What is the fact? You're mythic, you know.
The fact is that the group, whose name we will say as Up Against the Wall Mother Bleepers, and I was at that time known as Tom Mother Bleeper, moved from the Lower East Side to New Mexico, to a little town in northern New Mexico.
But before you moved to New Mexico, you enlivened the New York...
Well, we're going to get to that, but I thought you wanted to give them the reality of my name, which was a little herb that grows on the medicinal root plant that grows in the barren cutbacks of northern New Mexico and is very sacred and pungent, called OSHA root. OSHA is the name of the plant. OSHA root is the part that you use. You can still get it in herbal stores. So I named myself after that. Then who would have thought they would name a big federal agency after this little plant that grows in New Mexico? This was unexpected.
Well, isn't it an acronym for...
Office Safety and Health Act, right.
Right, and isn't that... The kind of...
Is that the kind of law I do?
Law you do.
Absolutely not. No. not even close. No, I represent people who have been abused by the police and most of the homeless people who are living in Berkeley. And I run and in Oakland in the East Bay, the San Francisco Bay Area. And I run, help supervise a legal... free legal self-help clinic where people come with all kinds of problems. You know, we're seeing the kind of people who are, basically people are getting screwed by the current economic system and not making it. So that's what the kind of law I've been doing ever since I've done law.
Many of them are, I'm not so sure this time, but some of them I'm sure are veterans.
A lot of the homeless folks were veterans of the Vietnam War. Now we're getting the veterans of the Iraq War. That's the homeless. But we're also getting people, I mean, that's a lot of the homeless folks I'm seeing. But we're seeing people moving from Main Street onto Skid Row and because they're losing their houses. They can't, they've fallen behind on their credit cards. They're getting sued. They have nowhere to turn. We're seeing all of that. I mean, they're just flooding in our doors. So that's the legal work I'm doing now.
But that was very far from your plans, wasn't it?
Well, I never thought it'd be. The idea of being a lawyer, yeah, never my wildest.
Because law is such a, that's
passionate.
But it's reason is the alleged root of the law.
Well,
and
the law
is
very little to do with reason and a whole lot to do with how much money you have. That's really what it is.
That's
reasonable. Way too many lawyers.
It isn't reasonable that poor people should get the same justice that rich people get.
You know what? On my legal pleadings, whenever possible, I like to quote. There's a famous quote by a French writer, Anatole France, who says that the law, in its majestic equality, forbids the rich and the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. So the rationality of the law is that majestic equality, but it runs up against the reality of the world. And in the reality of the world, it's not generally there for the people without money. So I'm a lawyer for people without money, which means I don't make a whole lot of money at the law, but that's all right.
Do you work independently?
For years. Now I work actually with a really good organization there, a nonprofit organization called the East Bay Community Law Center. And I work with, I supervise, I get to subvert the education of law students at the University of California.
You lecture to?
Well, no, it's a clinical program. I mean, they get all their lectures and all their book learning, and then they come down
to work
me,
with you,
and they see what the reality is of the law down there on the street. But did I think when I was a mother bleeper that I would ever be on that side of the law? No. I mean, I was imagined myself I would be an outlaw most of my life. And before that and since then, I've also been a painter and a sculptor and an artist. So
I understand.
None of which really that compatible the way people usually think of with being a lawyer.
I understand from Wavy Gravy, who I spoke to today, that you repaired the mural in Berkeley that was falling to...
Well, I didn't repair. I painted the damn thing. I mean, back in... Berkeley has this reputation, not entirely deserved, of being a hotbed of radicalism, the People's Republic of Berkeley. It never really was that. I mean, there was a thin stratum of sort of radical activity that was around the university in the 60s, but it was usually mostly a pretty conservative town. But there was a lot that happened there, the free speech movement and People's Park and the Ronald Reagan sent in the National Guard and tear gassed most of the folks there, but there was no murdered. Well, the Alameda County sheriffs came and were brought in, and they had their shotguns that were supposedly. This was during these People Park the riots around.
And there was a guy who was watching from
James
roof.
Rector from roof, whom they loaded there with. Not with birdshot, but with slugs and killed him. Blinded the guy next to him, a guy named Blanchard. There was nothing in Berkeley that memorialized that, so I decided to paint a mural that I called the People's History of Telegraph Avenue. Telegraph Avenue was the main throughfare there, and which showed this whole history, starting with the free speech movement, and we had going up through the hippie invasion, and then the People's Park. And the People's Park was a piece of property that was owned by the university that had a lot of student housing, low-income housing. They tore all the housing down.
Student housing? Or
there were students, poor people living there.
It's sort of like what happened at Columbia, wasn't it?
Universities all over, they're like that. I mean, they're very arrogant in relation to neighborhoods. And they were going to build some kind of dormitory, but they didn't. They left it a parking lot, and people took it over and made it into a park. And against the university's will, the university, still today, it rankles the university. But there was a huge battle about it. University came and it pushed everybody out, fenced it in. There were riots. That's when this guy was shot. So this mural shows
Reagan
all of
said,
that.
If they want a bloodbath, we'll give it
to
them.
Yeah, well, then they did. They did. Hmm. So this mural depicts that in Berkeley. And so we've kept that memorial up to that period.
Well, could you come back to the Lower East Side?
I can.
And to talk about the formation of the Mother Bleepers?
The Lower East Side was, I gather, it's not the same as it was then. It's a place where you could live pretty cheap, and when I got there, there was it was primarily a Puerto Rican ghetto. There had been layers and layers of prior folks, the Jews, the Ukrainians. The Odessa restaurant is still there. Gem Spa is still there. Those icons, B&H Deli, are still there. The place is there. But aside from that, you walk down St. Mark's Place, and it's like, Yuppieville. I mean, it's expensive and one snazzy restaurant after another. But it wasn't that way then. You could live cheap, and I went there to be an artist. But this was, as I walked in, I heard you describing the period and the sense of urgency and the horror that the Vietnam War, which affected us all. So there, in this ferment, all sorts of groups formed. In the Lower East Side, there was, it began with something called Angry Arts Week. In 67, it was a week where all over Manhattan and artists in all the different ways that they were doing art would make art against the Vietnam War. So on the Lower East Side, a group of us got together and we figured out what are we going to do. We're going to make various manifestations. What I did with a group of people is we went up.
You were a student at this time.
I dropped out of being a student.
What kind of what were you studying?
I was in history at Yale, and hated it, and dropped out, and decided I was going to be an artist. I mean, I screw it. I was going to be an artist. I didn't care anymore about my academic life. So I joined this group of people. So what we did is we decided we would go up to St. Patrick's Cathedral. At that time, the presiding person there was Cardinal Spellman, who was a major blesser of the war, these atrocities, the massacres, and it was all for God and Christ and so on and so forth. So we went up to St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Protector of the unborn as well.
And we had concealed under our coats a photograph. There was a famous photograph of the time of a young girl, maybe 11 or 12, running naked down a street. All the clothes had been burnt off her by napalm, and she's screaming. It was a harrowing photograph. And beneath it, we had the legend, "Thou shalt not kill." So we went in with the intention of disrupting the High Holy Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, unfurled our photographs, were immediately arrested. We'd been infiltrated. I mean, the guy sitting next to me turned out to be an undercover cop. Wham, I was out the door. That was my event. But I decided after that I was done with making art in my little studio. And there was time now to go out into the world and transform the world. And I met up with I helped form this group called the Mother Bleepers, which took its name from a poem by Leroy Jones.
Miri Baraka.
Yeah, Miri Baraka, right. Which he'd written. He'd written it, all the different ghettos were going up in flames. I mean, this was, as you said, I mean, the world was in flames. I mean, there was guerrilla movements in Latin America. The National Liberation Front, where the Viet Cong were fighting. These were all groups that we identified with. And in the ghettos, it was a time for black power. And Malcolm, and so this was the feeling, and the streets were going up. I mean, there was like
this,
a contagion.
When was this?
It was in 67.
67.
Contagion of riots, you know, often sparked by a police killing that were taking place. So Leroy Jones, now Amiri Baraka, wrote this poem called Black People. And it had the lines, "You can't steal nothing from a white man. He's already stole it. He owes you anything you want, even his life. All the stores will open up if you will say the magic words. The magic words are, up against the wall, mother bleeper, this is a stick up." So that was the spirit that we identified with, that spirit. And many people did. I mean, that phrase, up against the wall, mother bleeper, was hurled in the face of authorities, you know, all over. I mean, they hurled it at us, but we hurled it at them. So that was the name that we chose for this group. And it was
intentionally so that it couldn't be said on the news.
That's right, because we were not particularly interested in what the mainstream news said about us. And we were not particularly interested in being co-opted. That was not who we were interested in talking to. I mean, we got our word out with a flood of sort of apocalyptic flyers that we produced in our little, there were mimeograph machines, little Gestetner mimeograph machines that we churned out and put out in the Lower East Side. And we thought that we would...
Henry Tonight.
Henry Tonight. The Henry was our code name for a riot. I mean, you didn't want to say, let's go and riot on Second Avenue, but so we said, call for Henry. And our idea was that these hippies, these kids who were coming there with these ideas about, you know, how they would live free and live in a new world and drop out, had no idea the harshness of the reality. And that basically...
Did you feel that way about the Diggers?
The Diggers were actually somewhat closer to us. I mean, they were... Yeah. We wanted
They had the street on their feet.
Right. So yeah. we wanted to be the, first of all, the defenders of these people, but also to say that this movement had to be a movement against the horror that you were talking about in the Vietnam. You couldn't
Not everybody who was a mother bleeper, though, was as...
As what?
How can I say it? As dedicated to the principles that you... I mean, people were mother bleepers, I thought, sometimes for purely emotional, abreactive reasons. There were street gangs that formed alliances with the mother bleepers.
Well, no, I mean, we were a hard... I mean, the core of us were very, very committed. I mean, we formed this group. I don't know what you would call it. I mean, we called it an affinity group. The person who was the charismatic leader of our group...
Ben Morea.
He referred to it as a family. I mean, the same name that Manson used and the Cosa Nostra used. But he...
And that Usko used and the various other... the Brotherhood.
Yeah. I didn't call it. That was his term.
Right.
Terms for it. But affinity group...
But that was it was like a family that you chose yourself...
And that was what was happening. People
a lot of us were very alienated from our families.
Absolutely.
There's a wonderful scene in your book, Up Against the Wall, Mother
Bleeper.
Tune in later, we'll tell you.
Right.
I guess you can guess, though, where there is, you're a freshman in college.
No, I'm still I'm in high school.
In high school.
A senior in high school.
And you've probably just gotten a driver's license.
Basically,
You borrowed your mother's car to go on a date.
Right.
And daydreaming about the date, you tailgate somebody. You know, they stop and you don't hit the brake in time, and you smack into them. And yes. I don't know how damaged the car was.
Not that bad.
But you made a clean breast of it.
I was very shaken. I was very upset.
And you were looking for comfort from your family.
Right.
And there was, instead, they blamed you. And you...
Well, the story it's even more... It has more resonance for people who will know the players. Because when I came in all shaken from this accident, sitting on the couch were my mother and the man she had married after my father's death, Herbert Marcuse. And for those of your listeners who know this, and one of them is my niece Irene, who's in a bath surrounded by candles now, I think, listening to the show. But in any case, Herbert was a, like my father and his circle, were German Jewish expatriates, intellectuals, leftist Marxists, and he became they were refugees from fascism. And he became, in the 60s, for a generation that distrusted everyone over 30, in some ways a father figure. He supported, he gave intellectual legitimization to a lot of the sort of wilder elements of the 60s counterculture. And he had written a book called Eros and Civilization, which was a book which argued against Freud, that Freud had said, well, in order to have civilization, you're going to have so much repression of people's natural erotic instincts that they will have unhappiness and the death will triumph and, wars and so on. He argued against, you don't need that much repression. So he was... The person who the generation of the 60s looked to a lot, and yet he was for me a father who didn't really care and want to listen. So my first great act of rebellion, I picked up a alabaster bowl and threw it against the wall, breaking it over his head. Was
on his head or in the wall?
It wasn't that dramatic. So that was my first overt act of rage and rebellion.
But this
was against
a very important psychological moment for you. You kept part of these fragments of bowl with you,
and yes.
As a kind of a talisman or a a reminder of the, I think you say the regenerative value of violence.
Well, this is, we're getting into a complicated area here.
This is violence against property, which is what a lot of people made very clear was as far as they were willing to go. There was a moment in the history of the weathermen when there was a bomb that was going to be planted at a dance.
Yes.
In Fort Bragg, in the officers' club, non-commissioned officers' club, where they would be dancing with their families and their sweethearts.
Yes.
And this was a very... a very extreme change from what had been the policy before, because breaking the windows of banks and blowing up toilets in the Capitol didn't seem like it was stopping the war.
No, that's right.
That moment in particular, the breaking of the blowing up the toilets in the Capitol. I think there are some members of Congress who are still anally retentive as a result of that. That explains the Republicans, I think, a little bit. They pucker up and they vote against...
There's no question for me that... It's kind of obvious. I mean, I had an unhappy childhood mainly because of my conflict with my mother. It's a long story that I could get into. But anyway, I had a sense of sort of personal vileness and didn't feel good about myself. So that act that we were talking about was... So the first time that I didn't internalize it, I
didn't
let it out.
Didn't turn it against yourself.
Yeah, I didn't turn it against myself. And that was redemptive in some ways. And so it's pretty easy to go from there to joining the Mother Bleepers. I mean, I go from not having a good relationship with my mother to joining a group called the Mother Bleepers. It's kind of obvious. And there was an element of sort of infantile anger against parental authority that is part of some kind of politics. And I'm not knocking it.
I'm glad you say it's just part of something, because there was a very principled, I don't mean to say rationalization, because it wasn't a rationalization. It was a realistic decision that the only thing that was going to make the country stop doing things like murdering Fred Hampton was a reaction to these things.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the problem is that we didn't have a solution. We were all driven towards the moral outrage and urgency that we felt drove us more and more towards those kinds of extremities, and also in some ways modeling ourselves on the guerrilla movements, Che Guevara, the NFL, that took up the gun. But in fact, what happened is that we got...
The motto
was
bring the war home.
Yeah, and I totally understand. I was part of that, but also we got isolated. I mean, we didn't build the movement that would, in fact, actually transform this society. I don't know whether there would have been any way that we could have. I mean, I understand the dynamic that led us to where we were. But what happened was we changed the culture profoundly. I mean, the 60s changed the culture profoundly, and it seeded the society with a whole slew of what I call hyphenated radicals, radical lawyers, radical doctors, radical disc jockeys, radical journalists, and so on. But the system remained. And did not fundament. I think I think the powers that be really did feel threatened by us at the time. But we had, in some ways...
Bill passed me a note that said radical chic. Chic.
Well, it became that. And, the culture that was, that enshrined this... The genuine radicalism, now you go down the supermarket aisles and these rock anthems of the 60s that were anti-authority, they're playing in the soap aisles, you know. So we have not figured out how to do it. And we had, in fact,
I'm sorry. Well, there were other things that were going on, too. What was your feeling about the yippies?
Well, my feeling about we had an interesting relationship with it. I always loved Abbie Hoffman. I mean, I thought Abbie Hoffman was the real thing, and he was. I mean, he was genuinely courageous, you know, genuinely a person of profound imagination, a person really willing to take risks. So I loved Abbie. Jerry Rubin, I didn't have the same feeling about. And there was a real antithesis between the mother bleepers and the yippies, a lot around this issue of the media that we're talking about, because they really thought they could play the media. I mean, they would do a long march of revolution through the media, and they would put the media on, and they would turn the media into their own, against itself. So they played the media, and they were very brilliant at it, but we felt in the end that they were going to be captured by the media, that you couldn't be just all fun and games. So we didn't go that route. We thought this was for real, that we were not into the play of the yippies. So although we went to a lot of the same places, I mean, we ended up in Grand Central Station at a yippin that they called, where I got my head split open by some cop as I was going away, and we were all in Chicago, or at least I was in Chicago, a number of us. We had a very different style. There was a very different feel.
Were you there for the Days of Rage?
No. By that time, I was there during the convention. I was named an unindicted co-conspirator in the trial of the Chicago 8.
There's two of us. Don't
were you also?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Really?
Yeah.
Anyway, so but by that time, the mother bleepers, our rhetoric was beginning to catch up with us. For one thing, the Lower East Side was changing. The Lower East Side, the drugs were changing. It was getting more violent. There were biker gangs coming in and, you know, wanting to fight with us and fighting with each other.
You have a story of a confrontation between Ben Morea and the leader of a biker gang that ended with kind of an understanding.
Well, I was there. They were, you know, we went there to confront them, and they spent a certain amount of time circling each other with knives, and then decided, you know, that they were both they would let it go at the time. But
Well, there had been
so, but it was.
There, I mean, there hadn't been a lot of things going on that were probably inspired by COINTELPRO to split groups like that.
I never know how much, you know. I mean, we were certainly capable of being very self-destructive, quite on our own. I'm sure they helped us along, and we know they helped along, you know, with the Panthers and with AIM and so on. I don't know about the mother bleepers. I mean, the mother bleepers, I know that we were in their sights. I mean, they were undercover cops who were trailing us, and we got actually
infiltrated.
I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, people have some suspicion about one person who came in late. I don't think so. No, I don't think that's what it was. I think it's just that the tenor of things were changing, and I think we felt it was going to end badly. And then, but also, Ben Morea he was changing, and he began to feel that.
Now, his background was different from yours.
Totally different. I mean, that was one of the things that was extraordinary about the time, the two people so different. I mean, I came from this family of intellectuals, professors, gone to the best colleges, Swarthmore and Yale. He was a street kid and had grown up, I think never went to college, grew up, primarily among people of color, black people, was a musician, had been a heroin addict, kicked heroin, and then decided that if he was going to be go back to jazz, he would get back into heroin because that was so much part of the world. So he gave it up, and he became a painter, and he got into anarchism. Met Julian Beck and Judith Malina and Marie Bookchin. People got into anarchism, got into art, got into these movements, sort of Dadaist, surrealist movement. We're using art as sort of a way of confronting the conformity and changing consciousness. So he was very different. But he was also a street fighter. And he was actually a guy, I mean, I had no experience. I mean, I had this mask of a mother bleeper, but, you know, I was a timid, you know, middle-class guy. I mean, he actually knew how to fight, unlike me. But we came together. I mean, we had different things that we brought to it. But by the time, I mean, we lasted a very short time, but by the late 69, it was sort of time to get out. And there was a whole movement of, beginning of people moving into the country, New Mexico. Actually, Wavy Gravy was part of the hog farm, went to New Mexico and set up a place there. So we moved to New Mexico. The remnants of the mother bleepers, what was left, because people had peeled off, moved to New Mexico.
But you were under a lot of surveillance at that time.
There was a lot of pressure and a lot of surveillance. So, well, that's what I mean. I mean, walls were closing in there on the Lower East Side.
Were you a member of SDS?
We were a member of SDS, but we got our membership was primarily to go rail at them for their timidity and for their verbosity and say that they should stop talking so much and start taking action. So
Were you at the Pentagon?
I was at the Pentagon. But I was not with the group that that Ben was part of, that actually, I mean, you want to have the difference between the Yippies and the mother bleepers. The Yippies went there with Allen Ginsberg and so on. They said, what we're going to do, we're going to chant, we're going to levitate the Pentagon. The Pentagon is a symbol of evil. We will levitate the Pentagon. So that was, and they did their chant.
And actually rose about 5 inches.
Yeah. What Ben and some other folks did, said, screw this, we're actually going to break through these, we're going to go into the Pentagon and mess it up. So they actually made found a weakness in the line of guardsmen and so on, ran into a corridor of the Pentagon and, of course, met with a phalanx of MPs and beat them out of there. But that was sort of encapsulates some of the difference in style between the Yippies and the Mother Bleeders. But anyway, so we went to New Mexico. But we didn't go. There were a lot of people setting up these kind of hippie communes around Taos and so on. That was not what we were going to do. We decided that what we were going to do is our people. There was a group there led by a guy named Reyes Tijerina called the Alianza. And it was a group of, it was a land movement, a Chicano land movement. And they thought of themselves as Zapatistas. And they were going to lead an armed uprising in northern New Mexico to take back the land. A lot of the land that had been owned by the Mexican people had been taken over by the National Forest, and they were expropriated. So they began a series of armed raids. They took over a ranger station. Then they went into this town of Tierra Maria, rode into the town of Tierra Maria with guns, freed the prisoners in the jail, took the sheriff off into the forest and shot him, and then went off back into the mountains. Well, as you can imagine, the National Guard were called out, swarmed over northern New Mexico.
Good thing they weren't in Iraq.
Exactly. Reyes Tijerina was arrested, the movement collapsed. But we thought, well, these are our guys. I mean, this is the kind of people we should be with. So we went to, there was a little town called Canelon, which had been one of the centers of this place. So we knew, we met people there, and we said, look, we'd like to come up there. And, you know, if you ever want to do it again, you know, and you need some more folks.
Did you have any trouble overcoming their suspicion? You know,
there was some. At one point, actually, there were a couple of brothers who would invite us in there. But not everybody in that town was so into these people with their dreams of further revolution and bringing these weird hippies here who knew nothing about country life, couldn't speak Spanish, you know, were just complete doofuses when it came to... I mean, we just had no idea what to do. We were living off food stamps. We built an underground kiva and to have our rituals in, but we built it too close to an irrigation canal, so the water all came in. We rustled a cow and killed it, and we're going to... we thought, well, Native Americans used every part of the animal, so we took the skin and we tried to figure out how to tan it to make a drum. So I think there was one group said you should do it in urine. Another group said you should do it with bark something. So they combined, or ashes. So they combined the urine and the ashes, and the whole thing melted. And they were trying to burn out the drum, and it burned a big hole. I mean, we just didn't know what we were doing. So we were city kids. I mean, we then lived in the country. But in any case, at one point, we were in our place, and all of a sudden, people started shooting at us, or over our heads, I guess, we took as a sign of displeasure with our being there. But
at least they weren't ignoring you.
No. So that's where the mother bleepers kind of fell apart, and I left. The woman that I was with at the time, who became the mother of my two children, got hepatitis. She went to the West Coast. I went and visited her. We made love. She got pregnant. She said, look, you know, I'm pregnant. You can stay either with the mother or with the mother bleepers. And I chose to be with the mother rather than mother bleepers and left them. And they fell apart. I mean, there was the violence. The group had changed. They brought in a guy named Ben, realizing that people like me were not really great street fighters, felt that he needed some more muscle. He brought in one guy who was really kind of more of a thug. I mean, many people loved him. He had good qualities, but he was still kind of a thug. And he... went down to Albuquerque to try and rip off a dope deal and got shot, killed. Another guy went off and, I don't know, lived by himself and got wounded and got gangrene and died of, you know, blood poisoning. So things were really devolving.
You wouldn't see a doctor.
Didn't see a doctor in time. So the group...
Wouldn't,
I don't know. No. But in any case, the group fell apart there. That was it. That was where the motherfuckers
said it. Oh, well, that's
mother bleepers.
$250,000 fine.
There you go. Mother bleepers. Us. That's where the mother bleepers fell apart.
It was such an emotional moment for
it
you.
It was very. I know.
Telling
my
about
heart
that
is,
you just.
My heart is. My heart is going like
I
that.
I apologize and. If anyone at 1:50 in the morning hasn't, actually, it's safe for us here at WBAI, but it's much earlier in British Columbia and in Alaska.
And all those impressionable kids there are going to be listening on the internet.
That's true.
Anyway, so that was the mother bleepers. The book is a lot about that history, but it's also a confession of what...
Did some of your number become weather people?
No, but there were... The weather people were close to us, and there was influence by us on weather people. I mean, Mark Rudd was influenced by us. I mean, we had connections
well,
with
us. Well, you... When Columbia was...
We went up.
Right. Were you in the mathematics building?
Yeah.
Ben was in the mathematics building, and I guess Mark Rudd was, too.
and Tom Hayden.
Right.
I mean, there was just a reunion in April 2008 of the 40th anniversary of that takeover of Columbia, where the whole university was shut down, all the buildings were taken over, many of them, for over a week.
Over real estate.
It was a range of issues. There was the fact that Columbia had built a gymnasium on Morningside Park, the one park open area that was available to Harlem for recreation, and concession to Harlem was there was going to be a little back door in this gymnasium that the community could use. And this was not a time to have black people have to go in the back door of anything. So that wasn't going over very well.
And Columbia was doing scientific research for the military.
It was connected.
IDA.
Yeah, to the IDA. It was connected to the Pentagon. So those were... There was a range of issues. Those were the issues of the way it was repressive around the social life, particularly of women, the stultified nature of the education. I mean, there were a lot of reasons why people were angry with the university. But we were outside agitators. And for me, it wasn't about any of the particular issues. It was an occasion that Columbia was part of the system. And the view we had of what needed to be transformed was so total that any particular issue was only a small segment of the larger thing, and any occasion was an occasion to push the envelope and to demonstrate militancy and to be in some ways a vanguard by ones willing to take risks, propaganda of the deed. So we were going to be up there in the least timid way, and to, if it came down to a fight with the police, we were going to be ready to fight the police, and we were going to be the street fighters who were prepared to fight the police and would show the students who were, how it was to be done. That was sort of the sense of what we were about there. We went up there. I think for many people, this was at Columbia was a very transformative experience. It was their first experience of civil disobedience and so on. For us, it was, we hadn't been around that long, but already it was just one stage in this battle that we decided we were committing ourselves to.
A little bit more about the differences between you and the Yippies, because they were both attempting the propaganda of the deed, but different deeds. For instance, I was reminded of the St. Valentine's Day massacre last week. You remember that?
No.
Well, Jimi Hendrix bankrolled it.
Yes.
And a certain vast amount of contraband was bought.
Uh-huh.
And rolled into joints.
Uh-huh.
And envelopes were addressed to names that were picked at random from the telephone book to names that were taken from the list of judges and lawyers and government officials, and to news people. And I have a copy of the letter that was sent with it, and a letter from someone who, let me see. The letter didn't, too bad. The letter didn't print out.
You don't have a copy of the letter.
I thought I had a copy of the letter, but I can pretty much say what it was.
Uh-huh.
There was you opened the envelope, and inside a sheet of blank paper, there was another letter and a joint of marijuana.
Yes.
The letter said something like, well, this is it. Yes, it is. It's marijuana. It's pretty good. It's not the best, but it'll do the job. If you take a puff, slowly. You don't want to start coughing and waste it. And it gave instructions on how to smoke a joint. And it said, now, that's what everyone has been talking about. Is it so bad? Well, if you're not enjoying it in about 20 minutes to an hour, you'll be back to your old normal state. And if you are, you can probably try to get some more of it for yourself and give it to your friends. Be careful, though, because possessing it can make you liable to fine, imprisonment, and discrediting, and all of the other things that were done to people who were caught with this innocent medicine. The letters were sent out, and this I got a letter this week. You had the easy job rolling the joints. The real work was the logistics of getting them distributed. Thousands of addresses had to be typed. I believe we had typing teachers who assigned pages of the phone book pages to their students to type on labels as homework. Some were given pages of lawyers, doctors, etc. from the yellow pages. Others, most, were given random pages from the white pages, etc. Then they had to be affixed to envelopes, and stamps to both had to be licked. Even buying the stamps was a production, because we wanted and used four different commemoratives. Last, but far from least, they all had to be mailed at the same time. 2/13/69 So they would arrive on Valentine's Day. And to avoid the chance that they would all be discovered and stopped in the mail, they were mailed from all over the city. We gave shopping bags full of letters to people with an area of the city where they could walk the entire neighborhood, dropping a handful of letters in each mailbox in the neighborhood. One of the mailers in my crew was Crazy George Demoli. I gave him one or two shopping bags full of the completed letters, and always wonder when I think about the Valentine's Day action if they ever got mailed. George Demoli turned out to be a police agent.
He was a police agent.
Or if they were turned into his superiors. A reporter at, I think, Channel 5 News, maybe it was not Channel 5 because it was Bill Jorgensen, maybe Channel 9. He was the the anchor on Metromedia TV Channel 5, and that was 40 years ago this year. Attached is a copy of the letter, but it didn't print out. This is WBAI in New York City, speaking of failing to function in the accepted way, and also broadcasting on KWMD in Kasilof, Alaska, on CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and in less than half an hour we'll be joined by WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York, where the temperature this week was somewhere near 21 degrees below zero.
Where?
In near Monticello, New York.
Oh, my gosh.
And
hey, Bob.
Yeah.
Before the night completely goes away, can I mention where I'm going to be?
You're going to be here until 3:30.
Not
the night's
me.
Not going away.
Oh, no. No. I'm, you know. But can I mention where I'm going to be here in New York?
Yes,
where
people can mention see me Judith Malina.
Well, I'm going to be with Judith Malina on Saturday at 2 p.m. We're going to be talking about all this stuff about art and the fact that actually the mother bleepers and the Living Theater all had an event together when we took over the Fillmore
Auditorium
East from...
I was the MC.
Were you the MC there?
That's right. Until you picked me up and carried me off stage.
Okay, well, I would love to hear your memories of that. Anyway, well, we're going to be talking.
I have tape recordings of the entire.
You don't have it here.
No, I don't. They're in my mystery tapes.
But Saturday at 2 p.m. at the Anarchist Forum on 21 Clinton Street, I'm going to be there talking with her. And then tomorrow I'm going to be at Blue Stockings at 7 p.m., the bookstore at 172 Allen Street. So people can come by. And we can talk in person, not us at them as we're doing now. But then back at
We can take a few calls, sure, too.
Nobody's awake now.
Oh, they're calling.
Oh, sure, they're calling.
By the way, did you know that in one of Herbert Marcuse's books, An Essay on Liberation, he puts in a few good words specifically for the Living Theater?
He does?
Yes, he does.
I'm surprised at that, because that was not his view of what art should be.
Well, he gave him a good mention.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. Well, that was an important book for that generation, and still
one of his later ones. Yeah.
You're on the air. And you're on the air.
Do you enjoy being a moron? I was just wondering.
I don't know. He's trying to mirror to you.
This sounds like Bill Weinberg.
It does.
Bill, well, is it fun for you, Bill?
I don't know what. That you might do worse than make up Dante's rare movement of compassion in hell.
It sounded like Bill Weinberg at
first. Certainly did sound like Bill Weinberg.
This is late night radio, isn't it?
Yeah. He was at NAFCHA.
Well, we're at 212-209-2900. Should you want to talk to Tom Mother Bleeper. Well, you got to be here at least until we can say the full name of your organization.
Well, what, you mean in 10 years or what?
No. It's earlier in the evening at...
Less than an hour over here.
Kisilov, Alaska.
At 2 a.m. here.
And
I can't guarantee that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we gave him a sneak preview.
You're on the radio.
How do I get that?
You're on the radio.
See, I told
you. You're on the radio. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, good morning.
This is the radio?
That's right.
Hey, man. I was wondering...
Militant organizations?
I think, I'm not sure there should be. I mean, it's time for new kinds of struggle and new ways of doing it. But the groups that remind me most of who we were are the groups that people call the Black Bloc. The Black Bloc, the anarchists that go to the demonstrations and do not follow the precepts of the demonstration organizers and break away and run down streets and start breaking windows and so on. I mean, I think I look at them and I think, I recognize something about, you know, of that spirit, and I've got, mixed feelings about it. I think it's part of making a revolution, but it's also not enough.
The book, your book, Up Against the Wall, Mother Bleeper, details how you developed those feelings.
Yeah.
From kind of a feeling that anger would redeem you and violence would redeem you, to feeling, no, this is not what I had bargained for. So it was as though you went from naivete to understanding what violence, the implications of violence were.
You know, it's not that I reject it. I don't. reject that. I think that energy is part of, going to be part of any struggle, revolutionary struggle. But it also can be self-defeating, and it can it almost.
It's unavoidable in a certain way. I mean, you know that breaking the window of a place that, I don't know, the people that you're trying to organize go to enjoy themselves is going to be misunderstood if your meaning is stop the war or stop, bring down the creeping meatball or...
Yeah, that's not primarily what my concern. I mean, we did recently in Oakland, California, on New Year's Day, a BART police officer, BART is our subway system.
Who shot someone.
Right. There was a report of some kind of an altercation on one of the trains, and they pulled all the young black men off the train and lined them up against the wall of the station. And then one of them, they pulled out from this line and they shoved him, made him lie down on the ground, face down on the ground. And they, in fact, actually before they do that, I think one of these cops punched him, but he was lying on the ground, hands behind his back. They were in the process of handcuffing him, or they had. And this one cop, Johannes Messerli, who was, you'd see that the whole scene was captured by camera phones.
Yeah.
And you see this cop sort of more or less crouching down over this guy, standing up, pulling his gun out, and he shoots him in the back, this guy lying prone on the platform. Shot him in the back. The bullet bounced off the cement, bounced back up and hit him in the chest, and he died there. It did this right in front of all these, it's pretty crazy. I mean, it's hard to comprehend exactly what was going on, and we may never know what was going on with this guy. He's now been charged with murder, yeah. But...
He was arrested.
He fled to another state first.
Huh? Yeah.
He fled to another state.
He went, well, they knew where he was. He went to Nevada. He said he was afraid for his life, right?
But he's been indicted, hasn't he?
Yeah, for murder.
So that in itself is a big change.
Well, but the point of the story, which gets back to the issue of you know, demonstrations and violence, is that if there was a week or more where nothing was happening, the DA, the guy wasn't arrested, the DA didn't indict him, he hadn't been arrested, he hadn't been charged. And everybody was kind of shilly-shallying around, and groups organized to protest and had rallies. And after one of these rallies, people broke away, and they were heading, I think, for the BART administrative building. We got shut off, and they broke windows. There was a police car that had been parked there blocking the thing. They jumped on the police car, broke windows on the police car, set fires in trash cans, and eventually 100 and something were arrested. And after that the DA charged this guy with murder, and the BART board started taking action. But what happened was that all the local officials and the newspapers all decried the violence and they shouldn't have done it and so on and so forth. And I went on KPFA, the sister station in Berkeley of the station, and I said, you know, I wasn't going to condemn that. I felt like, you know, if they assassinate a man that way, the police.
When George Jackson was murdered.
What are you supposed to do? What
when
are these,
George
these
Jackson
people?
Was murdered, the weatherman blew up a police.
Right. I mean, it isn't all a
correction headquarters.
It isn't all a part, but it is totally appropriate for people who feel utterly powerless. They're not the kind of people that politicians listen to. Young people, black people who can identify, young kids who can identify that this could happen to them, that they tear the place up. You know, that the message gets across. You can't do that without and still, you know, have everything go on as usual. So there's a place for that. It's sort of like good demonstrator, bad demonstrator. You know, then all the good lefty, the progressive can say, oh, you've got to do something, or you're going to have chaos in the streets and
counterproductive.
Even Martin Luther King used the threat of urban insurrection to say, "Look, you've better give us what we want."
Jack Kennedy said, "If you make nonviolent revolution impossible, you make violent revolution." Right. Inevitable.
Do you think that level of protest was responsible for getting the indictments?
Not only that, but that was a part of it. I think it could have been. One never knows. Yeah. But I think it. People then think, well, wait a sec. We can't just go on and prevaricate and do business as usual. So that's why I don't completely reject that kind of part. But because I've been there, I know also some of the limitations of it.
Let's talk a little bit about the Fillmore.
Well, you know, Bill Graham started in the West Coast, opened the Fillmore in San Francisco. He'd been started all of that, he had been the business manager of the mime troupe. But then he began to make a bunch of money off this stuff. And our position as the Mother Bleepers was youth culture. This was a counterculture. He was making money off it. The kids in the street who were on the Lower East Side who were hanging out there squatting in the squats in the Lower East Side, they couldn't afford to go to these concerts. He needed to give something back, and we wanted a free night for the community. And so we went to him, and we said, hey, we want a free night. He said, no way. You know, there's no way I'm going to give it to you. And we said, well, you know, you are actually going to give it to us. We're going to make sure that you do that. And he said, I remember I was there at this meeting in his office up above the Fillmore. He pulled out these bullets and he put on these three bullets, and he said, these were given to me by the Hell's Angels. You know, and if the Hell's Angels didn't scare me, you guys aren't going to scare me. We said, well, you know, I don't know about the Hell's Angels, but we're actually, you know, whatever the Hell's Angels did, you're not going to be able to function your business. And then he said, you know, I forget what his name was. It wasn't Bill Graham, it was Grumpy. He's a Jew from who grew up in Poland, and had a rough childhood. I think sort of escaping from the Nazis. He said, "Look, I fled the Nazis. I got away from and I'm you're not going to scare me, and you're not gonna, well." We got our free night. There was an incident which I'm not particularly proud of, there was an event that he had. It was actually supposed to be a benefit, I think, for the Columbia strike. He wasn't letting people in to the theater. And I think one of these Puerto Rican street kids, he was at the door himself. He was not an uncourageous man, blocking people from coming in. And one of the Puerto Rican street kids that was with us hit him with a bicycle chain. Blood was coming down from his nose. Anyway, he gave us the free nights, and they were incredible, insane, wild scenes. I mean, I describe it in the book. And we had events there with the MC5.
Kick Out the Jams.
Right, Mother Bleeper, and the Living Theater and so on. But, you know, the play was total bedlam, and all the drug laws of the state of New York and the federal government were broken, and, you know, toilets were clogged and so on and so forth. And eventually the police said, look, we're going to shut you down if you do that. And it ended. But we had for a while those incredible nights. So that was our big confrontation with Bill Graham.
He also spent an evening on the stage arguing.
Right. We had a meeting about it where he which he had thought of as a debate between Ben Morea, the person, and himself. He'd set up this chain. We were all supposed to be the audience, and he was going to be up there having them. But that wasn't how we did things. So we went there with our mimeograph machine, pulled it into the center aisle, were churning out flyers and yelling out and so on. And that meeting didn't amount to anything. There was eventually a negotiation, actually, that Wavy Gravy helped.
Was there a moment when he was tied to a chair?
No, that's mythology. That never happened. No. That never happened. But it was that moment where we felt we would take back the culture. And there's, you know, we see what's happened to the culture. It didn't get taken back. It did get commodified, and then you need new cultures, new countercultures, new music.
And he ultimately met his demise working for the Clinton campaign, I think.
Bill?
Yeah, his chopper went down.
I know his chopper went down.
I believe it was.
Is that what happened? Mm-hmm. No, I didn't know that. Yeah. Yep, died in a helicopter crash. Anyway, so that was that interaction with him. One of the few, much of what we did was not memorialized because, you know, there weren't all those cell phone cameras and video cameras and digital this, that, and the other thing around at the time. But that confrontation, actually, because it was Bill Graham and Phil Maurice, was pretty well documented.
Well, as I say, I have tapes.
And you have tapes of it, which I would love to hear, because I'd love to know how much of what I remember is pure fabrication, how much actually happened. I know the Living Theater came in. They had the Living Theater's whole thing was to sort of bring together life and art and have the theater come off the stage and sort of shock the audience by the nakedness.
Beautiful,
and so on.
Nonviolent socialist revolution.
But the audience that we had of those freedom, there was no way they were going to be shocked. I mean, they were every bit as crazed as the Living Theater was.
You're on the air. You're on the air.
Michael Lang. Hello?
Hello. You're on the radio.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
You have gravy in your ear, perhaps a Q-tip. Oh. Do you need a Q-tip? Perhaps you don't need a Q-tip.
Wavy Gravy.
How you doing?
We were just talking
about
you. Is
this Ocean
2? Yeah.
Is she from that other East Side commune?
Exactly.
And what's your book called?
Up Against the Wall, Mother Bleeper. A memoir of the 60s with notes for next time.
Oh.
I should get you a copy, or you should get a copy.
And, Bob, I understand your movie is coming out soon.
Oh, I don't know how soon. You know,
that's what I used to think. But
yours is...
mine was 10 years in the making, and it's coming out. It'll premiere at South by Southwest.
Is it, Wavy? What's the movie?
It's called St. Misbehavin', The Life and Times of Wavy Gravy.
All right.
And it's a...
Temple of Accumulated Error.
This is correct. And truer words were never spoken. I am...
I'm sure truer words were spoken once.
Eagerness. And...
You had a screening of the movie that I wasn't able to attend tonight. I'm sorry.
But, that you can come to Texas, Bob.
We're going to be at the Austin Film Festival,
South by Southwest. I've been lost in Austin, which is a great Mark Benno song. I love it there. I did a big Seva show there. It's Maynard Downs, finest motor horse race track in the state of Texas, and don't you forget it. And also, Willie Nelson's Roadie Pootie. Did you ever meet Pootie? He's a big, giant dude with a ponytail. And he has this honky-tonk in Spiceland out. No, I can't tell that story of introducing the guy whose name sounds like the Scientology guy, but is different, and wrote Up Against the Wall, Redneck Mother. Well, that's appropriate, and your book title and all.
Yeah, your title done, is being ripped off.
I have no idea what. Yeah,
Up Against the Wall, Redneck Mother. So Mother, yeah.
Wiley Hubbard is something like
right.
it.
And he wrote a book called what?
Up Against the Wall, Redneck Mother.
It's a song. It's not a book.
It's a song.
But it'd be very useful in your book thing. Because it's not sure.
David Peel has a song of the same name too.
And also the MC5.
Right.
Used to say Up Against the Wall.
Everybody used to say it.
Kick out the jam.
It was everybody. Where is David Peel?
Lower East Side.
Still. David Peel is still on the Lower East Side?
I think so.
Oh, my goodness.
I remember going on the road with him, and we were doing the Medicine Ball Caravan with also the late Reverend Thomas King Facade, who had a giant hearse with a Viet Cong flag painted on the side and a four-poster bed on the roof. And he came into, we rolled into Yellow Springs, Ohio. And instead of the four-poster bed, he had on the roof the turret to a B-29 Flying Fortress. And I saw it, and I had all this jello in the possum belly of the bus. And the jello we got because after Altamont, we were asked to do a festival in San Luis Obispo, and I thought, like, instead of Hell's Angels, we can have a moat full of jello. And so I wrote to General Foods, and it was taken seriously because I was the police chief from Woodstock. So they sent me all this jello, and then the town fathers and mothers in San Luis Obispo freaked out, and they didn't want to have a rock and roll festival, so we just put the jello in the possum belly of the bus and left it there until I saw this B-29 Flying Fortress. It looked like a giant dessert dish, and I said, "Let's fill that bitch with jello." And so we put it on the stage and started mixing up the jello all night long, cherry jello. And it jelloed perfectly until the sun got to around 10:30, 11 o'clock, and the jello started to de-jellify and turn into soup. And I thought, we are doomed. But then we had the inspiration, dry ice. So we went and bought out, I assume, all the dry ice in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and tossed it in the mixture, and it re-jellified. And not only did it re-jellify, but it became geo-jello thermal, like these great gaseous bubbles of dry ice fume would rise up from the bowels of the jello dish and go bloop, bloop, and I mic'd it. And people made this amazing banner. It said, I'm not making this up, it said, "World Peace Through Smoking Jello." one of the great banners of to stop the war.
Well, Tom used the phrase before, Wavy, the propaganda of the deed.
The students started diving in the Jell-O Bob.
Was this...
And then they started doing carnal acts in the Jell-O. And the Jell-O juice is flying all over the place. And we had to go elsewhere. In fact, we were heading to Washington, D.C., and didn't have a opportunity to clean the Jell-O slime off all of the wires from Owsley's Olympic Sound. And we got to Washington, D.C. with Alice Cooper, who proceeded in the night to shoot off a flare. And then he shot off the flare and then disemboweled a pillow. And all these feathers came floating down to adhere themselves to all the wires of Olympic Sound. And we had to spend days picking the feathers off the wires and cursing Alice Cooper to an eternity in Wonderland. So that's that story, and that's it.
Yes, and the moral of this story?
Oh, yeah. There was a moral.
Yeah, when?
Don't, you remember the moral to that story, John? It's something about...
John, do you remember? Help me out here. There's a moral to this story.
Don't let your jello
look. It's something about, don't let them... be jumping in the Jell-O.
Well, that's a very good moral, very important. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me suggest something else to remind you, that in those days you would go to a demonstration against the war and you would come home eager to see what the news made of the tens of thousands of people who were protesting the murder, and you'd find that it wouldn't be mentioned. And then the yippies discovered that if you did something that was outrageous or funny or shocking, the news media would pay attention to you. And this was the not exactly the propaganda of the deed, but the, Al Lewis said that when he was working a medicine show throughout the South, he would get to the center.
The Adams family?
Yeah.
The Munsters.
The Munsters, right. He would get to the center of the town and set up two barrels with a board on it, put a third barrel in the center, and put pitch on fire in that barrel. And the flames would shoot up higher than the tallest building in town, and people would come running, and then he could make his pitch. That was another one of the motivations, to get on the news with a statement of, promoting peace was an impossible task. And that's what that's why I thought that the mother bleepers and the other outrageous groups
doing the die-ins and the Breton Puppet Theater with the giant statue things and giant heads and stuff.
But they didn't try and get in the mainstream media that much. I mean, they
were speaking of mainstream media, we are now broadcasting on WJFF in Liberty, Grahamsville, and
Jeffersonville,
New York.
In addition
to KWMD in Casilla, Alaska, and CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia,
hey.
And We are on the World Wide Web, streaming live at WBAI.org. So there's a whole world of people who are listening to us, Wavy, as we...
I'm WavyGravy.net.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say that the biggest press we ever got, we didn't have that much of an idea that we were going to get it. We were in Stockholm, Sweden, for the United Nations Conference on Human Environment, and we were there at the behest of the Point Foundation, which was put together by the Whole Earth Catalog, and they floated our Greyhound. We had a 48 Greyhound. They floated to Sweden, and they flew us there with a bunch of Indians, like Rolling Thunder. And the poor Indians, when they went to Sweden, they would do ceremonies for when the sun would go up and down, and that was like every half hour or something. They got big bags under their eyes. And we were given an airfield outside of Stockholm to set up our field kitchens and stuff for all the hippies that were going to arrive, because this Kabouta Provo dude put signs up all over Western Europe of U Tant, who was the Secretary General at the time, dressed as a beetle, saying, "See you in Woodstockholm." And so to greet the hippie invasion, the hog farm was there to have a giant free kitchen, and we had a stage, and we brought over the Holy Modal Rounders with us, who asked the musical question, "Do you like boobs a lot, boobs a lot, boobs a lot?" And then some ingenious Swedish border patrol guy had the idea, "Let's don't let any hippies into Sweden." And so they sealed the border to hippies. So there we were, all with our thumbs up our ass, with nothing to do but entertain the alcoholic home across the street, which, you know, would give us a fairly sizable audience of formerly drunken Swedes. And this woman came into our camp just before the start of the UN Conference on Human Environment, named, what was her name? Joan, anyhow. She was there from Project Joan.
I remember her also.
And wanted us to do something to save the gray whales. Huh. And she had this pendant around her neck that was of this whale, and we had our bus there, and our bus looked a lot like her pendant. And so we had this collective brainstorm: let's dress the bus up to look like a whale. We had all this black plastic, and we went at it like little beavers, and actually arranged for the bus to squirt water out the top like a spouting. And we had a PA, so we were able to play whale singing. You know, you've heard the moan and groan. Of course, everybody has. And we had flukes, which we were able to walk along outside with a fishing leader and poles and make the fluke go up and down. And we proceeded to drive the whole thing into downtown Stockholm into rush hour. And it was the day before the UN conference, so the world press was just standing there with nothing to do but pay attention to our whale. So we not only got to give the Secretary General of the conference a proclamation about saving the gray whale, but we got on the front page of every newspaper practically in the world and every TV show in the world. And the UN passed a resolution against the killing and hunting of gray whales as an endangered species, which was amazing. Of course, at the end of the conference, we had a big parade and an amazing event against the killing and hunting of human beings that is an endangered species, because the Vietnam War was raging, and they didn't even mention that it was not good for the environment. But although it caused the Secretary General to cry, it didn't make all that much of a wave. But the whale, the bus dressed as a whale, is the hugest piece of mass media that I've ever been involved in, into getting them to pay attention to something. And it just happened inadvertently, like spontaneously. So that's that story.
Well, Wavy, you were an intermediary between Bill Graham and the Mother Bleepers at one time.
Oh, God. Ed and Bill, they were going at each other with garbage can lids and tire chains, as I remember. Can't we all live in peace? Oh, my heavens. Bill eventually became a good friend. And when I began the Save a Foundation, the first show that we did with the Grateful Dead was at the opened the Kaiser Auditorium, and it was a benefit. Bill was the producer, but he didn't even know it was a benefit. And he went into a mad rage. Why am I the last to discover these things? And he later slipped me this note, and I looked at it, and it was a check for $10,000. I said, Bill, why are you doing this? He says, because you did not hit on me, my friend. So Bill had many aspects and sides to him.
Wavy, yeah. Your history and your story is fascinating, and your movie is probably very worth seeing. But could you say a few words about was the essential difference between the Mother Bleepers and the Weather People and the hog farm?
Well, I remember a couple of wonderful things that happened. One of them was not so wonderful. Was when the Mother Bleepers invited the entire. We decided the hog farm. We wanted to get some foundations to give us money to ride around and do our stuff, and so we scored this big concert hall in NYU, the Loeb Student Center, to do this gig, which
as
I was.
Lord Buckley said, "Knock me your lobes."
It was called Meet the Pudding, and we had a huge vat of chocolate pudding in spoons. And the concept was that everybody was going to feed each other.
I remember that very well. For years, we got complaints from NYU about what you did to their new floor in the gymnasium with the chocolate.
Because the Mother Bleepers invited the entire Lower East Side to come to our event, and I heard this, and I looked around, and this guy was covered with pudding from his navel to his fontanelle. He grabbed the microphone. He rolled his eyes. I've seen the bottom of the pudding. And the pudding is flying everywhere. And we did. The pig was skinning all over the place. The pig is this pig that we had stashed in Abby Hoffman's bathtub. I saw Joanna tonight also. She was at the screening of my movie. It was nice to see her and Stephen Benn and Gary Goodrow. Marshall's in L.A.
Yes, I know.
Anyhow, they probably still would like to hunt us down, because we warped the floor of the Loeb Student Center with chocolate pudding. But my greatest thrill was showing the Mother Bleepers the slides of New Mexico on a freezer at Gucci's. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
Oh, shit. anyhow, Ben was totally inspired. And
he was.
Got him to drive out to New Mexico, and he's still there. Is he not in Colorado? Or?
Yes, he's still in Colorado.
I thought he was in New York.
Bob, you know, you keep asking about, I have a little piece, and can I read you a little part? I mean, exactly the question you're asking about the difference between the mother bleepers and the hippies?
Sure.
Right. Please.
Because then I got to actually head out of here. This is in my book, which people can get.
Excellent.
Unlike the mother bleepers, who were always in battle mode, both Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin played the revolution for laughs. Prancing in front of television cameras, they acted the part of revolutionaries having fun playing at being revolutionaries. The revolution would be televised. Revolutionaries would become media personalities. The media was there to be manipulated. It had to be seduced into spreading subversive messages. The first rule for revolutionary engagement with the media was unpredictability. Dance between seriousness and put-on. Invent realities on the spur of the moment. Keep them guessing. Charm, beguile, threaten, and disrupt. Turn politics into a theater of the absurd. There was, of course, a price to pay for all that media attention. The paradox of serious revolutionaries playing at being revolutionaries who believed that play was revolutionary tended to collapse into a simple, unparadoxical lack of seriousness. The media invariably extorted its pound of flesh, turning subversion into titillation, subverting the subverters. We were both envious and contemptuous of the yippie media stars. We were the antithesis of the Abby and Jerry show. The media could not speak our name. We clung to the grubby reality of the Lower East Side. The Black Panthers were more our kin than the yippies. We did not bleep around. That kind of is the way I mean, you keep coming back to that question, what was the difference in style? That's sort of my take on
that. Do you agree with
that,
Wavy? I mean, I would take exception to some of that, because I think, Irish revolutionaries talk about the laughing boy.
I'm saying this is where we were at. I mean, that we also would use humor.
Humor had its place, and the bleepers had
its
place.
Yeah, we were funny.
We played the whole spectrum, and you needed to use all the tools.
Yes. I think that's right.
That's right. I agree.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, thank you, Osha.
It's been a pleasure.
So, Osha, happy you going to back see- to Berserkly?
I will be back in about 3 or 4 days, back in Berserkly.
I'm loving how the mural is holding up.
Well, thank you.
And nobody's graffitiing.
No, they love it. Where are you now? Are you in Berkeley?
I am in the Cement Apple here. We just had a screening of my film where did we do that?
We're both here in the Cement Apple.
Some place or other. And we're about to go to Pennsylvania in the morning. And to spend time with our month-old grandson. And then it's back to Berkeley. You'll probably beat me there, but not by much.
Well, enjoy your grandson.
And thank you for all the legal assistance you have given to people that needed legal assistance and couldn't afford the big bucks that you usually have to shell out for of stuff.
Thanks, Wavy.
You do an important thing there, and Hosannas too. You know that Ben Mother Bleeper is Ben Eagle, of course, and is my son's godfather.
Is he really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
And do you speak to him frequently?
Oh yeah.
Well, tell him that his godson has a son.
I will tell him.
So that we'd be a son of a godson.
Take care, Wavy.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I take it because you're taking those earphones off that you don't want to answer a few more calls. There might be a few more people than that guy who thinks he's doing a Hopi dance.
Let's see whether we get a real call.
Okay. All right. You're on the air.
Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. And
good morning.
And Tom. I hope you can stay for a little while. In fact, I hope that you, for our audience up here, I would like to ask you to repeat everything from 12:15 to 1:30. Also, an Irish attorney friend of mine may be listening, and he may want to call in and I don't know, pick your brain for some methods of fighting some of the bloodless so far activity that may be happening in this area. I don't want to go too far off topic, but it was really a great show so far. We did announce at 1:30 the topic and what you were going to discuss. So we're only 10 minutes from Safe Harbor when you can say the name of your old organization. So it'd be great if you could stay for another few.
Well, we're going to maintain
Safe Harbor discipline here
until it's okay for people in Kisilov, Alaska.
Oh, there you go.
Well, that's only another 10 minutes, I think.
Right. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well,
Well, it was great to hear some of your methods about mimeographing sheets of, you know, activities and demonstrations and this and that. Bob's audience is already familiar with what's going on up here, so I don't want to go into detail and I don't want to keep you either. But any pointers on how to fight corporate terrorists who intend on knowingly poisoning people through their water supply?
I'll give you a little bit of a background on this. There's a method that's used for extracting gas, natural gas, from shale.
Yeah.
That involves taking massive amounts of fresh water and infesting it with chemicals and superheating the water and pumping it underground to fracture the shale.
Yeah.
And then the gas can be pumped into containers or pipelines or tanks or trucks or whatever. And the water can never be reclaimed after that, and the water. I mean, I have a list of poisons that are in the water as analyzed that's used to extract the water from the shale, and the water is being. The plan is to dump this water into the aquifer that supplies New York City. So this is a serious problem.
The number of gallons is just overwhelming of the chemicals. They intend to use an average of 4 million gallons of water per well, and they intend on having 28,000 wells in the area.
Oh my goodness.
And they claim that it's only 1% of the water that they use, but 1% of 4 million gallons is 40,000 gallons of chemicals.
Oh my goodness!
And then 60% of that water, 60 to 80% of that water, comes back out, and is then put in holding ponds for a while until, of course, it's flooded by rain or whatever, and then they intend to take it to a treatment center. But not only is it full of chemicals, it's also mildly radioactive. And there's no way to cleanse the radioactivity. So the deal is this:
you have to be patient.
Yeah.
It exhausts itself in 500,000 years.
Yeah,
exactly. The deal is this: the policy of the state of New York is to explore for energy, which that's understandable. The DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation, claims to have control of this, which they do not. They deny. They claim only 88 chemicals are used, or 65 rather, and we know of 288. The Attorney General's office, one of the questions put to a hearing at the Attorney General's meeting when they came for comments from people who have signed leases or were about to sign leases for the with these drilling companies. One of the questions put to them was, if my neighbor drills for gas and my property is polluted and my family dies of cancer, what can they be charged with, or can I charge them with something? And the Attorney General's office said, you can't, which I thought was outrageous.
You can't what? You can't charge?
Can't charge them with felony reckless endangerment, which also should be a Class E or a Class C felony.
But what about, are there civil lawsuits against them
to try and stop them? Not yet, because so far we're holding them back. They're very active in Pennsylvania, which is also within the watershed area for the drinking water of New York and Delaware and Pennsylvania and Connecticut.
Yeah.
The next question to them was, what if I advise my neighbor beforehand of the chemicals being used, then can they be charged? And then they hemmed and hawed and said, well, I don't know, I guess so. And then the people's attorney claimed that it was not their responsibility to prosecute. Where do we go with this?
You mean the DA wasn't
going to... And we'll double your fee for your evening.
Yeah, well, no, this is way beyond. But the DA is not bringing criminal charges of what you're saying.
Right, they said they wouldn't, not on an individual basis, probably not unless it was a class action suit.
But any nonprofit or private lawyers can bring a civil action against these people.
Right.
I mean, you don't need the city attorney, the district attorney, to do it.
Well, I'm just saying that was a question put to them. The reason that these people are so hungry to sign leases is because they're not financially in great shape to begin with. So to hire attorneys to fight this. Is hard, right?
Yeah, but these are the kind of cases where if you can get, I mean, there are groups that do this, and then they also, I mean, some of them are funded, but also this is the kind of case where if you win, in many cases you can get attorney's fees. I mean, a lot of poor people get represented because the law allows the prevailing party to get attorney's fees. I mean, police misconduct cases are always that way. People who the police beat up are never people with a lot of money, or very, very rarely.
Mm.
So the lawyers who take those cases, take them if they win, they can get their fees. So the fact that people don't have a lot of money should not be necessarily an obstacle to finding legal representation. But it sounds like, I mean, it sounds just so crazy, but it also sounds like a thing where there would be wide support for stopping this.
Well, there are many people. There are many groups fighting this, but of course, there's no one that has more money than the Petroplex.
Yeah.
You know, they're the biggest player on the planet at this point.
You know, I mean, we're all struggling to figure out how to do this stuff, and it all seems like it requires all the different approaches. There isn't any one approach: the legal approach, the legislative approach, the demonstrations, the going door to door, the initiatives. I mean, you use all of them.
The yippies and the mother bleepers together.
And, you know, one part of it can be people, you know, the people who are really pissed off, who take some kind of action that then the other people will deplore, but actually galvanizes people. And
legal and extra legal and every other.
Yeah, you write the letters, you go and visit the congressman, you sue them, you demonstrate in the streets, you do things that are illegal, you commit civil you know, and you see, it's like throwing everything against a wall and seeing what's going to stick. And I don't think any of us have a formula for doing these battles.
Those that say they do, I wouldn't trust anyway.
I wouldn't trust them anyway. That's right. That's right.
Well, that's what we've been doing, is trying everything, including putting up the list of chemicals and shopping centers and
things like that. All that stuff. I mean, it sounds like one of those things where if people know what's going on, they would be alarmed. I would think, and rightly so.
One question that I had, this was from a previous fight that we fought up here when when the gaming industry was trying to take advantage of the Native Americans with a casino.
Yeah.
And the folks that were representing the claim that they were representing the Mohawks in this case were not really Mohawks. And what we did is tried to use their own tactics against them and just put a in the legal section of the newspaper, the paper of record, in the legal section saying that these folks don't represent us, you know. And my thought was that, you know, what if they come to you in 6 months when they start break ground and build this casino and they say, well, why didn't you ever protest this if these guys don't represent you? And I don't know if that helped or not, but at least that ran in the local paper in the legal section for several months. Would that something like that work also? The list of chemicals, like anyone signing a lease, be aware that you may be responsible for the health of your neighbors, knowing that these chemicals are being used to extract gas from your property.
Sure, sounds that way to me.
It would seem so, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and we'll have to do a fundraiser.
It's true. Well, stuff, you know, stuff takes money, and then there's stuff that doesn't take that much money. But that's always one of the issues. I mean, one of the good things about the web and all the internet stuff is that it makes it possible to organize and reach people in a way that was never possible before, with minimal amounts of money.
Speaking of minimal amounts of money, this is WBAI in New York City.
Yeah.
WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York. Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty. CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. And KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska. And we are streaming on the World Wide Web. I wonder if Alaska was colder than Monticello this week, Fred.
Yes. Yes, they actually were.
They were. You were. Where were you?
We were at the station. It was 23 below, and my place it was 21 below.
Huh.
But this evening it's a blistering 11 degrees.
Oh my gosh! T-shirt weather.
Right.
Well, I'll either sit in the background and wait for another caller, or I just want to thank you for a really good show and for our WJFF audience.
You ought to try to pick up this book. I don't know whether there's a bookstore that will sell it in your part of the world.
That would be good.
Yeah, there is a bookstore, Hamish and Henry, in Roscoe, New York. Then hopefully, I'll try and get down there or order one, or if you can leave a copy, I'll
up against the wall, Mother Bleeper. It's from Seven Stories Press.
Okay, that's great.
Right.
And just for the JFF audience, if anyone's listening, you folks should really go to the WBAI archives and listen to the beginning of the program. It was a really great program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank,
thank you,
you,
Bob. Thanks, Tom. Thanks,
thank
Tom.
You. Thank you.
too nervous. Can't relax. Can't sleep. Bed's on fire. Don't touch me. I might be like fire. Psycho killer.
I know how you want it, darling. 4 years after the revolution and the old king's execution, 4 years after, remember how those courtiers took their final bow. String up every aristocrat, out with the priests and let them live on their fat. 4 years after we started fighting, Mara keeps on with his writing. 4 years after the Bastille fell, he still recalls the old battle yell. Down with all of the ruling class, throw all the generals out on their ass. Why do they have the go? Why do they have the power? Why? Do they have the friends at the top? Why do they have the jobs at the top? We've got nothing, always had nothing, nothing but holes, and millions of them living in holes, dying in holes, holes in our bellies and holes in our clothes. Mara, we're fools, and the poor stay fools. Mara, he fought and he fought unafraid, sniffing down traitors by traitors betrayed. Marat in the courtroom, Marat underground, sometimes the otter and sometimes the hound, fighting all the gentry and fighting every priest, the businessman, the bourgeois, the military beast. Marat always ready to stifle every scheme of the sons of the ass-licking, dying regime. We've got new generals, our leaders are new. They sit and they argue, and all that they do is sell their own colleagues and ride upon their backs, or jail them, or break them, or give them all the axe. Screaming in language that no one understands of the right that we grabbed with our own bleeding hands when we wiped out the bosses and stormed through the wall of the prison they told us would outlast us all.
Marat.
they hunt you down. The bloodhounds are sniffing all over the town. Just yesterday, your printing press was smashed. Now they're asking your home address. Poor old Marat, in you we trust. You work till your eyes turn as red as rust. But while you write, they're on your track. The boots mount the staircase, the door's thrown back. Poor old Marat, in you we trust. We trust in you.
Alice Brown, he lived on the outside of town. Alice Brown, he lived on the outside of town. With his wife and five children and his cabin broken down. You looked for work and money, and you walked a ragged mile. You looked for work and money, and you walked a ragged mile. Your children are so hungry that they don't know how to smile. Your baby's eyes look crazy, they're tugging at your sleeve. Your baby's eyes look crazy, they're tugging at your sleeve. You walk the floor and wonder why with every breath you breathe. The rats had got your flower, bad blood had got your mare. The rats had got your flower, bad blood had got your mare. If there's anyone that knows, is there anyone that can?
I'm a man of wealth and taste. Get around for
There's a long pause. I thought we're... Bob, I see the phones are still ringing. Want to hear some more music?
All right. Well,
what do you think?
Hi there.
Oh, wait a minute.
Well, come on. Hey, what did you think of that? What did you think of that last piece by some people who are a little bit less inauthentic?
The real McCoy, if that isn't mixing metaphors.
Yeah,
what real McCoy. Okay, well, I guess we didn't have a call after all. Shall we go on? Okay, I think they get the message. I'm not sure what it is, but shall we...
Well, there are some other calls.
Okay, you want to... Fine, let's get rid of that.
You're on the radio.
Hold on a second, Bob.
That's more than a second.
Yeah.
That's a few seconds.
Well, yeah, hi.
Okay, you're back. Okay.
Yeah. Listen, that early caller who sounded like Bill, I think he was a neo-anarchist. Radical individuality, Bob.
I didn't think, I thought it wasn't actually Bill calling in, but for a moment I did. It was a recording from Bill's show, I think.
That's what I think it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what they do. I've met a few of them. That seems to be like the latest movement.
What?
Neo-anarchist.
Neo-anarchist.
Yeah, neo, right. Radical individuality. I was talking to one of them, and I asked him who his hero was, and he said Daffy Duck.
Good.
And
Situationist.
Yeah. He quoted, he said that Robert Downey Sr. was a neo-anarchist.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Neo-neo.
Yeah, he quoted that...
Hey, listen, everybody does the best they can, you know, with whatever occurs to them when there's a... Oh, what happened?
Whatever.
When there's a horror that they can't stand, they try to do something about it. People can only take so much, you know?
Yeah, he quoted that...
Did you hear about that guy who killed himself and his whole family because he couldn't find work?
When was this?
This week?
No.
Five, like, beautiful children all on the front page of the Post. He's like a modern-day Hollis Brown.
So anyway, this guy quoted Downey Putney Swope, the orphan kid, the woman who was scamming, trying to scam Putney, who she was dressed as a nun, had this little orphan with him, with her. And he said, bleep the establishment and bleep you and the anti-establishment were trying to make me a part of it. I think that's the whole philosophy of the neo-anarchist now.
You know, an awful lot of political thought... in the actionist section is like philosophized after the fact, you know. I was watching the movie of The Weathermen today, and Todd Gitlin, who, you know, I've known for a while and I've had some good conversations with him, seems like so... I don't know, like hopeless. Like there's just some things you can't do. And then, of course, he draws the line at violence. But the violence that was contemplated was minuscule compared to the violence that that provoked it. But he says that there's essentially no difference between deciding that a principle is more important than a human life, whether it's Stalin or Hitler or Ted Gold. It's profoundly important now, I think, because we're going to have what they call a reaction when people see that even Obama is stymied by some of the things that the powerful people are going to put in his
Absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, Bob.
So we're going to have what you call a revolution of rising expectations.
Of course.
You know? And, I think it's a good idea for people to see how violence, resorting to violence, it just doesn't answer the question. All it does is, like, help you to get your rocks off.
Well, I had a friend who was doing living theater.
I mean, it makes other people say, gee, you know, it really is a horror. That guy burned himself to death because of it, you know? But,
What year was the living theater, Bob?
It still is.
Yeah.
It still is. It was, formed in 1958.
Yeah, well, that's when my friend was doing it, the Beat Generation years.
Who was your friend?
I was this Jewish kid from the Grand Concourse.
That could be a lot of people.
Yeah. Anyway, he was in rebellion against the great superego, Jehovah, and creation, you know. He used to pretend to read from the Bible, from Genesis, and we get to the part when God created man and saw that he was good, that he would go into this whole thing and say, man is not good. The design is flawed, and then he would drop his pants, he would moon the squares. You know, the thing was to shock the squares into consciousness, self-consciousness. So he would drop his pants and moon the squares. He says, look, this is why it took us.
Right.
This is why it is not good.
Right. Bim bum.
Yeah,
bim bum. Right.
Right. He was trying to shock the squares into self-conscious at the way holes, you know.
He was a wonder rabbi.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's hard not to see that Jesus is the same someone who was so affronted by something being done to people that he gave his life for it. I mean, in the myth of Osiris, all of the heroes of the human race have this willingness to sacrifice the lives of themselves and others for some principle. And it's getting kind of old, don't you? War as an instrument of policy, it just doesn't really work, you know. Diplomacy, something, figuring out what the grievances are, that seems much more likely to produce civilized results.
Well, I think that dilemma is what motivates the neo-anarchist into what I think is escapism, trying to, you know, just get away from it all. So they'd ridicule everything.
Well, everything is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's total theater of the absurd.
Are these the steampunks?
I beg your pardon?
Are these what they call the steampunks?
No, this guy called himself a neo-anarchist.
Oh.
And I couldn't get anything out of him except that his hero was Daffy Duck, and he just walked away. You know, like that was like nothing. Because I'm a rational anarchist, so I couldn't get I was trying to get a rational response from him. And he thought that was absurd. It's a weird movement.
Didn't Kropotkin once say something about, like, yes, I am absurd, and I shall continue to be absurd until those who are truly absurd stop being absurd.
Yeah, but he was exercising some logical thought there, right? Well, but these guys now, yeah, I mean, but, there's no logic to what they do. Well, I mean, there's a whole...
Well, tell me something that they did that you thought was illogical.
Well, I don't know, because I just ran into a few of them.
What are they...
In the village, West Village, and... Mm-hmm. I just go through the old places where, you know, just hang out where I used to, like, years ago, the old coffee shops and everything. I don't know if you still go down to the village, Bob, do you?
No? Occasionally, yeah. But, I mean, there are a lot of places in New York City that I don't recognize anymore, places mostly where... poor people could have a good time, you know.
Anyway, Bob, I'll let you go to another caller.
That was good.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Could be you. Hello?
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. I'm enjoying your show very much tonight. Took me back 40, 45 years ago, and it seems that nothing's really changed, and it only got worse and quite frustrating.
Well, I think things have changed. I think there are some things that have definitely changed, and some of them are actually big improvements. What's your point? I'm sorry,
I interrupted you. No, I was listening to you guys talk, and you know, you mentioned Vietnam, and now we have Iraq, and then somebody was talking about how the water is being poisoned, which I knew about. And years ago, we were talking about the environment. And
no, but you see, these are all things that we can put our efforts and we can try to do something about all of these things.
But there's not the people that come out in mass anymore.
Oh, it's cold. Wait till it gets warm again.
But, you know, but even if...
And did you see the people who were celebrating Obama's inauguration?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. It was some of the best music I've seen on YouTube ever.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Did you see Garth Brooks?
No, I didn't.
Wow. Just wonderful.
No, I understand.
Wonderful.
It seems that, I don't know, I hope maybe there is a miracle and people will come out and push Obama to do the right things.
Well, you know, I thought that they did an interesting little turnaround. They waited until the Republicans lined up and voted strictly along party lines to see whether they were going to cooperate or not. And when they saw that the Republicans weren't going to cooperate, they began to talk about indicting some members of the Bush administration. You know, it's like they're both going to have to play hardball, both sides in this contest.
Well, you know what, I hope about...
Because things are worse than they've been for forever in this country.
Yeah, you know what? I just hope Obama could be like a football player and just push these people out of his way and get to his objectives, whatever he'd like to do. But there's one thing I'd like to ask you, if you could talk about it for a minute. I guess you and your guest knew Abby Hoffman, and I'd like to just ask you what he was like, and I'd like to hang up and listen to what you have to say.
He was brilliant, and he was for real, and he was funny.
Yeah, because I admired him so much.
You did. Have you read any of his
Yes, of course. And I used to see him a lot. One time I was in Massachusetts, and there was a demonstration. So I joined in, and I think he inspired me tremendously and changed my whole way of life.
In what way?
Well, I could say I was a good American kid when I was younger, and I believed in everything, like the Lone Ranger.
And God and Senator
Well, I'm still that. I believe in all that stuff. It's just we got some we got some rascals who were trying to steal it.
It's after and hours. We you don't have to say rascals now. It's after hours.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Well, they're after what's yours and mine. They're after ours.
Well, it's just that I enjoyed him so much. And
yeah, and Abby was very serious about trying to protect it and get it back.
Absolutely.
Did you read about where he was when he was on the lam, a fugitive?
I don't recall.
Well, he had a new identity.
No, that I didn't know.
Yeah, when he was underground. And he couldn't help but get involved in organizing to save the
river.
The river, yeah.
A Thousand Lakes area. Well,
right.
Right. He had a hideout in the Great Lakes. How many thousand islands can there be, right?
Yeah, you know what always made me laugh when he said that the rumor was that he was the illegitimate son of Judge Hoffman. Mm-hmm. When they had the trial of the Seven, Chicago Seven.
Right, have you seen the movie?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you got to do a lot of catching up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, I try to see a lot of things. You
Chicago
know.
10, it's in the video store.
Okay, because I saw stuff.
Get it from Netflix. I think you can even see it online.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of things, and I think
PBS carried it.
I think the thing that most impressed me recently was the Motorcycle Diaries.
Yes, wonderful.
Yeah, that was
wonderful.
Yeah, and I haven't.
Wonderful. It's one of the best young man buddy stories that I've ever seen.
Yeah, same.
About Che and another medical student.
Yeah, it was his cousin.
Who buy a beat-up motorcycle and travel, or attempt to travel, the whole length of Latin America, South America. And
it was a terrific movie. And yeah. The other film I liked was V for Vendetta.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, that's terrific. You should really see that film with Natalie Portman, and she's a great actress.
Yeah.
Shouldn't miss it. Thanks for putting on a great show tonight. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and you probably should keep in mind that there's that movie about Wavy Gravy that we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Okay, thanks so
Bye
much.
Bye now. You're on the radio. You're on the radio.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, hello.
And hi to your co-host. I keep forgetting his name.
Bill.
Hello.
You know what's ironic is that, you remember Mark Rudd led the demonstrations in the 60s up at Columbia?
Yeah.
And then, ironically, last year, the same Columbia students beat up the Minutemen for free speech. So I guess things change, don't they?
Well, the Minutemen.
Yeah, they were expressing their disapproval of the immigration policy, and let's put it this way. We may not agree with what they're saying, but they have the right to say it. At least that's how I was taught. And at the same time, Mark Rudd was advocating the right of free speech. But that's not why I called. Bob, I want to ask you.
Wait a minute. Did Mark Rudd beat anybody?
No. We're speaking about the offspring of the radicals.
Well, after 40 years, people have learned that you can't allow fascists to demonstrate their hate. It hurts
that's a subjective
people
thing,
too much.
You know That's subjective.
No, no.
What is a fascist? Huh? What man's fascist?
I think the first thing is that makes someone a fascist is when they say that the state is more important than the individual, that business is more important than life, that we're us and those people are not us, and not us has got to go.
So I think
the world belongs to everyone on it. Every inch of it belongs to everybody on it.
But in effect, you're saying this gentleman didn't have the right to say that he thought the law should be upheld?
We've heard it.
No, well, we've heard a lot of rhetoric on BAI, too, but we still listen, right?
He thought that the law should be upheld?
Well, the fact is there's certain things that are violations of certain federal and local codes, and he wanted to express his point of view. I think, during the South African demonstration, I stood up at NYU and defended, and I'm a black man, I defended the right of the representative from the South African embassy to speak while the other blacks wanted to shout him down. I think I want to hear what my opponent has to say. What are you scared of?
Well, I've heard it, but, if your opponent is saying something that I really consider inhuman, I don't know. I can't express it. I think from the point of view that you're looking at it, I guess I agree, but a campus, in a way, is not a public forum.
Why not?
Because it isn't. Because because they can call the cops. Because it's not Union Square.
No, but he was invited by the university.
They protested.
And no, a bunch of students jumped on stage and physically hurt him, and I found that offensive. But more importantly, I have a question, and I need.
Well, some of the students jumped on stage and hurt him.
And not one others of them. Was of them
other the others were horrified.
I was horrified. Some,
well,
yeah.
There you were. You see, so it's not. We are.
We are
a mosaic of people who are in some different emotional states. You know what I'm saying?
I agree with you. When you
stir up these passions.
What passions? Free speech?
No, it isn't. It isn't.
Oh, it's not free speech.
It isn't.
Disagree with it?
No, that's not what I'm saying. Well,
now you're trying
to shout me down.
No,
right?
I just said what are you?
No, I'm saying that there are certain kinds of speech that are hurtful.
Like.
In polite society, we call them the words that are indicated by different letters of the alphabet. There are some about every single group.
But yeah, comedians use them on the media every day, and no one protests.
Not every day, and
well,
not all comedians.
No, but some of them made millions off of it.
And you know, like any transgressive joke. It can go very flat, and it can hurt people.
And who is the judge of that?
Whether you laugh or cry when you hear it, you're the judge.
Well, I'm sure if the Ku Klux Klan told a joke about blacks,
listen,
the Klansmen would find it funny. I would find it appalling.
One of the things that made me happiest in my lifetime was when the Klan held a meeting near the army base where I was... Durance, where I was serving my country.
You should be proud of that.
That the Klan. Well, I'm not proud of it. I'm resentful of it because it came at a very bad time in my life, and it was because of the trumped up Cold War And I had to go through a lot of stuff to get my good conduct medal, let me tell you.
Well, I was a draft dodger, and I feel less than a man than you. Because
what?
I couldn't fulfill my obligation to proving that I'm disciplined enough to know that if I want my country to improve, I have to contribute something.
Yes, but you don't have to contribute your life, your precious life. You think the state is more important than your life?
I don't know how to. I can't answer that one. But
well, I can. I say
that's why I said
no,
you're more of a man than I am. You have the right to say what you want because you fought for the right and earned it.
I didn't fight.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
I was in the peacetime army.
Yeah,
the Martians could have attacked any day.
I stood on St. Mark's Place getting high while people who were of your ilk who were better than I went there innocently and later became back druggies and murderers, the whole thing. But the fact is that you got to respect them because they believed in something. And you mentioned Abby. Abby was a great guy, but Abby didn't believe in anything.
I don't know about that.
Well, anyway, I have one last question.
I don't know about that.
I have one last question for you, Bob. I was on a train on the weekend, and you know the trains have irregular running schedules and whatnot, and there was this one gentleman there that was coughing. And coughing without covering his mouth.
Fascist pig.
But the fact is, we asked him 3 or 4 times. Do you realize, Bob, that I think the AI would be performing a public service if they would hand out handkerchiefs and Kleenex? When I was a kid in school, it was the proudest thing to pull out a handkerchief because the teachers taught us, our parents taught us. Unfortunately, Bloomberg has got his head up his behind, and he doesn't realize that we're destroying ourselves because we don't have any sanitary codes.
What happened to those public toilets we were supposed to have in the city?
You tell me. I still use the sides of buildings. Good night.
The toilets were an experiment, something like, the late news.
You're on the radio.
Yes, good morning, everyone.
Wait a minute. Don't tell me. I know who it is. I
Bob,
recognize the voice. Wait a minute. Is this Monroe?
This is Monroe.
Fine.
In 49 years.
What's new?
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, if you've been listening for the last couple of weeks, if not months, when they have the beginning of the Spanish news program, no longer do you hear that this is an experiment.
Oh.
I brought it up to what's his name? Bernard White, the program director, when he was doing a wake up call in the morning, and I said, he said to me, Monroe, what's on your mind? And I said, well, Bob, Bernard, I said, for the longest time, I can understand at the beginning when it was said this is an experiment. We'd like to have Spanish news on WBAI because so many people, citizens of New York City, are Hispanic, Latinos, and so forth. And So it was an experiment at the beginning to see if it would continue. And it's continued, I said to Bernard, for a very long time. So it's not really anymore an experiment. So I would appreciate it, and Bob Fass and Bill Propp, I'm sure I can say for them, because I got the impression from the way they spoke.
Excuse me, Monroe.
Yes.
Could you identify the station that you're talking on?
I think it's WBAI.
Yeah.
FM.
No.
99.5.
That's not with all your knowledge, Monroe. 49 years of membership. You don't know how to do a station break?
Well, Bob, I'm trying to do it, and I believe a station break should include the various facts.
Now, all it has to include is the name of the station.
I did that.
And the location of the station.
I sort of said New York, but I said 99.5 FM.
Well, yeah.
And that's our location.
But the name of the station must not be separated from the location of the station.
Well, what do you mean when you say location? New York City, yes.
That's right.
Broadcasting from the Empire State Building transmitter via the transmitter.
Well, you certainly know your stuff, Monroe.
Anyway, Bob, they no longer have this intro. They just when the WBAI local news is off. On comes the Spanish-speaking news, and so it broadcasts, and then you come on, and this wonderful program occurs. Now, the other thing I wanted to bring to your humble attention and my humble attention is that what's his name? Bob Franks, Bill Frank. What is his name? The gentleman on WNYC, he once was a
Joe Frank.
Huh?
Joe Frank. Right.
Joe Frank. Did you ever meet him?
Yes, years ago.
He had a program on WBAI for a short time. I was impressed with it.
Well, I wasn't on WBAI at that time.
I was banned and fired during that time.
I was banned and fired.
Oh, that was when you were banned and fired, huh? Mm-hmm.
One of the top
things. Anyway, he now does this program from on Sunday night before midnight from 11 to 12 on Sunday night. And I've been listening to it. Of course, I usually listen with two radios. And
you listen to WBAI at the same time?
Yeah, you know, the voice quality is different, so you can...
What's on what's on the rest of the band while Radio Unnameable is on?
Come on.
You know, I don't think we gave a legal station break yet. We were talking about it.
That's right. I'll have to do it, Monroe. Excuse me, Monroe, this is WBAI in New York City, and... KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska.
Yeah, right.
CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. And WJFF in Jeffersonville, Liberty, and Grahamsville, New York. When we're broadcasting, or streaming, as they say, on the World Wide Web. Monroe, what have you got to say to the world?
Well, I'm trying to say that Joe Franks broadcasts from 11 to 12 on Sunday on WNYC AM. And they do offer a disclaimer that if you're very sensitive to rough language, you might want to turn away. But what I want to point out is that as his program unfolds, to him, about their psychiatrist and psychologist and so on, and they use
Let me clear something up.
Yes.
There is no uniform interpretation at the moment of the FCC's rulings. One station will say, well, it's important for... the kids in South Park to speak realistically, we'll take a chance. And they'll have enough money to defend it. They'll get away with it. Another station will talk about something else that... But the people at WBAI are so terrified that if we get into trouble, we won't be able to lawyer our way out of it.
That
they're being super cautious. There was an F word dropped in the program with Robert Downey. Remember that program, Robert Downey Senior? And so because of that, someone made the, I would say. I was about to say idiotic choice, but we'll choose a more friendly word. The overly cautious choice to take it off the internet where there is no restriction.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
that's stupid. It's stupid. And that's what happens. That's what happens when there's a chilling effect at work. And,
but the thing is, WBAI, let me say, its reputation for having brought James Joyce to the public, arena, with long readings. I dare say once it was read from beginning to end, so on and so forth, that what I'm trying to drive at is that WNYC is able to scot-free just by, and this is before midnight, not even, what I'm really getting at is...
Well, Monroe, I agree that it's absurd.
Well, I know, but I wanted you to know...
I know.
Like tonight, somebody didn't say...
I know. Oprah can talk about things in the middle of the afternoon that they won't let me talk about after midnight.
Yeah, I know, but I don't want to see you castrated. I don't want to see myself.
No.
That's mighty nice.
I don't want to see Allen Ginsberg's great work, Howl, not be able to be spoken. And let me say it this way to you, Bob and Bill and everybody listening. Our world... that has been struggled for by you and Mark Redd and the SDS people and Cloudy and Jeff and George Riker and so on. Our world has come down to this horrible, chaotic, nasty, rotten place where bailouts of printed money that is not based on anything but printing presses.
I was talking to Danton and to Robespierre and to Marat the other day, and they said,
John,
things are going from bad to worse as things change. I think there's a similarity in this period to other.
I know, but I'm
not interested
in similarities anymore.
Well,
I think that the United States of America, our land, although we're allowing all sorts of varieties of attitudes, and although...
Oh, Monroe. He's gone. And you're on
the
air. Hello?
Milkshake, bartender, with a lot of yogurt shaker.
No kidding.
Quack, quack!
It's Daffy Duck. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, hi.
Yeah, hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you?
Well, I'm all right. I'm a little, things have turned around this time. But I'm a little depressed, the times I'm going on right now to just...
Well, you're a man of your times.
Yeah, I'm only 28. So.
Well, you are. They're saying this is a depression.
Yeah,
economic depression, and you thoroughly represent it.
Well, it's sitting here hard for me. All the jobs like that, the stimulus package... Well, I don't know what this patch is going to do, but I think it will work. What about the jobs?
Did you read about that story that was in the Post?
Well, about the package?
No, about the man who lost his job.
I heard about that. I think it was in Florida. Nice family,
beautiful family, yeah. And he knew that without his job, the family would go through hell.
Well, you know what happened was, they said that, you know, he and his wife owned some kind of, it was him and his wife, they were like a medical aid system like that, and they was some kind of fraud, you know, and that's what made them lose their jobs. It was him and his wife, they was caught doing, some illegal.
Well, you know, so you're saying that because he did something illegal, he deserves to be so terrified that he could kill his family and,
I mean,
Bob Dylan's song, Hollis Brown?
No, I don't know, but no.
No? Do you mind if I play you a couple of versions of it?
The one that I really want to get into is that you got another Bernie Madoff guy. I don't know if you saw that already.
There are some big thieves.
Yeah.
There's some big thieves, and there are some people who are small thieves who get the techniques from the big thieves, and
it's another jerk, you know, that's up there, just like one by one. I mean, devastating time of Enoch, the economy. I mean, people like Bernie Madoff, you know. I mean, it just make life so. I mean, just so. Depressing sometimes.
Well, you know, capitalism creates greedy people.
Right. You know. I mean. It's just really humiliating, to hear about that.
Well, we can do better. You're on the air, too. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
Good evening. it's pretty interesting what conversation you're having tonight. Very historical and inspiring to look at history. I was a New Yorker here as a young woman, New York advocate. I just feel like even though, and maybe you can shed some light because you know so much of history.
It's another way of saying I'm a geezer.
Well, you're interesting to speak with, you know, to say the least. So. Interesting to hear. So, you know, just even though with this new sense of hope with our new administration, it seems, you know, ironic. It's a hopeless feeling time that we're in, despite the tremendous enormity of hope that seems to be spewing or trying to spew out of Washington, D.C. at this point. This hopelessness in New York City and through, I'm sure it's throughout all the cities across the country too, but at least here as a New Yorker, it's like too many things. I think we're hitting a wall, socially with social thinking, with, transformations from, to different types of energies that we're looking into now, to new monies that are coming in, new people that are immigrating into New York City that really don't, that have more language backgrounds than what New York City's had in history. It just seems like there's a real big transformation, and something for me is pivotally getting lost, and that's the sense of what history has offered us in this country, and that's civil rights, and that's social thinking, and I don't want to go as far as revolutionary thinking, but...
Well, I just want to say that these people that I was talking about tonight, you may not agree with a lot of the things that they did, and certainly they were a big problem for me. They were the anti-war heroes, you know? People who went to jail because they were, on the FBI's most wanted list. People who were terrorized, people whose homes were ransacked because they were against the war. These are the heroes. What?
That seems almost a bit, it seems, contra civilization, civilized society, and contra, it's almost bent on violence already. It's just, that wouldn't be acceptable. But in New York City,
I'm glad it's not acceptable to you. It's not really acceptable to me either.
Exactly.
Although there was a time when, I can't say I tried to be, I stopped being nonviolent for a while the first time a cop hit me. There was a, more or less peaceful march on the way down to City Hall.
What was it?
And this unmarked car, drew up alongside. Some guy jumped out of it and threw a punch at the tallest guy in the crowd. And it happened to be me. And that's when I thought, nonviolence is not the only alternative. It's something.
What was this? What was this?
About 1967, 65, maybe.
And you got punched.
I got punched. I got my glasses broken, and
I wear glasses too.
And it seemed so unprovoked by what was going on.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
But it was an attempt to intimidate us, and that
and
was
it's still
infuriating.
Going on.
Yeah,
it's still going on. Actually, with let's say individual citizens here in New York City that are exercise their rights either in health care or in employment or in the justice system. Maybe they're going through family court. Again, I'm an advocate, so I get to see get to hear these types of cases. I get to hear people's grievances and in systems where they're trying to voice their opinion, not just their opinion, their right to speak, their right for family, for employment, for healthcare, proper healthcare attention, perhaps psychiatric attention. In these particular systems, at least within the five boroughs, there is a retaliation going on. There is a very established behavior against people exercising their rights.
Right. These are entitlements.
Exactly.
They're things that the law says must be given to you.
Right.
I know some people, even people who work in these agencies, sometimes resent that. But the reason that they do. Is because they're so understaffed and so overworked. There are so many mouths and so few spoons.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And so they get resentful because
all over. So.
Right. But there are an awful lot of people, nonetheless, who go out of their way to make dealing with the bureaucracy easier. I know that.
You
know, but mostly they're in the offices where there aren't too many people.
Right. But can an individual, the recognition of an individual to defend him or herself in the judicial process here in New York City, whether it be criminal or civil, is losing an individual, say myself or yourself. We want to go against certain policy, let's say in family court, let's say in domestic violence and the issues that are current today that are affecting us largely in New York City and five boroughs. Can one person challenge a policy within the correct right?
No, but yes.
Yes, no?
Yeah. It has to be done if you have a website and you want people to notice it, you have to use other media to publicize it. So you have to find an ombudsman who can take it outside of the agency, because in the agency people are going to want, you know, things to be as calm as possible. They don't want to learn new rules. No.
Oh, you mean external, like an ombudsman, externally?
Right, and they're
address that agency.
Right, and there's been hiring freezes in a lot of agencies, right? And because of that, the people who were there are very, very overworked, and not to mention underpaid.
Yeah, you know, I heard about that one time, hiring freeze. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And in New York, I mean, let's just talk about a really specific. Let's just take. I want
quickly
to
though,
because
we're going to have to get out of here in a little bit.
Oh, you're going to get okay. Let me just get your response on this MTA, if you would like, this MTA debate where public hearings and the board is just like the chairman of the board is completely bent on getting this money from somewhere. What do you think New Yorkers, if we are upset about it, obviously coming out for public hearings, what do you think as New Yorkers we should be doing right now to even gain more ground and express our voice and let ourselves even be heard up in Albany even stronger so that the fares will not go up for us? What do you think, my question
well,
is,
it has,
what do you think we should do?
Organize.
Or I should do.
Organize. Organize. I don't know. One thing that occurs to me is a subway strike, the boycott in Birmingham, where people stopped riding on the buses.
Okay.
And so if people stopped riding on the subway,
how do we get to work then? I mean,
well, there'd have to be a general strike as well.
Okay.
We look at it, the gas prices. I mean, that's what I worry about.
Listen, we're going to have to get out of here.
So
it's been a gas talking to you. And play that Hollis Brown. Good night. Thanks for calling.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Hollis Brown, he lived on the outside of town. Hollis Brown, he lived on the outside of town. With his wife and five children and his cabin broken down. You look for work and money and you walk the ragged mile. You look for work and money, and you walk the ragged mile. Your children are so hungry that they don't know how to smile. Your baby's eyes look crazy, they're tugging at your sleeve. Your baby's eyes look crazy, they're tugging at your sleeve. You walk the floor and wonder why with every breath you breathe. filthy rats that got your flower, bad blooded got your mare. The rats that got your flower, bad blooded got your mare. If there's anyone that knows, is there anyone that cares?
Good night from Radio Unnameable, and I have some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that Ibrahim Gonzalez is not going to be here this morning, but the good news is that it'll be a surprise. It's a great surprise. Ahmed Ali is here this morning. And
well,
and it's great to see you. Thank you.